Welcome to Vermont Favorites, a production of WBTV LP Burlington 99.3 FM. I'm Adam Rabin. Each week I talk with musicians, artists, performers, and creators about their unique journeys and what they love about living in Vermont. I had the pleasure of sharing a stage with my guest today for a few years when we were in the 80s cover band Hot and Neon Magic. And a few years after I showed her the dance moves from the Love is a Battlefield video, she taught me the basics of improv comedy. But seriously, she has done so much before and since in theater, music, and comedy, including starting up the Vermont Comedy Club. She is one of Vermont Business Magazine's 40 Under 40. Please welcome Vermont favorite, Natalie Miller.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you doing this morning?
Tired, good.
Good.
I've got my coffee. I'm good to go.
We're set. So you are, in fact, a Vermont favorite. You're from Vermont, born and raised. Lindenville.
All about the NEK.
Yeah. In fact, you've kind of incorporated those roots into one of your weekly, or not weekly, but semi-regular acts.
Oh, yeah. We have there's an improv team that I'm on called the Kingdom Kids, and it's all, it's four of us. And we all grew up in the Northeast Kingdom. So it's myself, my husband, Nathan, who grew up in Sheffield,
yeah.
John Matthias, who also grew up in Lindenville. I've known him since I was five.
And I didn't realize.
Yeah, okay. And Brian, who grew up in Newport.
Oh, great.
Who is significantly younger than all of us. But
yeah, I'm aware.
Yeah. He makes us feel old.
Yeah, but he's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
So you grew up in Newport, and I'm trying to figure out, Brian grew up, and you grew up in Lindenville,
mm-hmm.
Right? And you're, and in fact, you talk about knowing John since you were five, and your husband's mom was your high school chorus teacher?
Yeah, correct. So I didn't know, Nathan is 8 years older than I am, so we didn't really know each other. I knew who he was because he and his sister and their friends were like the high school kids. It sounds gross in retrospect, but we didn't date until I was well into my 20s and blah, blah, blah. It's different when you're older, you know?
I would hope.
But I was like a middle school student, and he was a high school student putting on like sketch shows and plays and stuff. So I knew who he was. But we never interacted or anything. His mom was my chorus teacher, and she actually is the reason that we met as adults. So,
oh, brilliant. Okay,
yeah.
I didn't know that part of the story.
Yeah.
So, out in the Northeast Kingdom, we think of it as kind of like the wild frontier, but yet there's still seemingly an arts community and arts.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, there are, so Catamount Arts is in St. Johnsbury, and that's a great resource. There's a film house there where they bring all the indie films in, and they bring in, you know, we've done comedy shows up there before,
right.
And they bring in music acts, and yeah, there definitely is an art scene up there. And Nathan's mom ran a children's theater, which she doesn't anymore, but it still runs every summer. It's called Vermont Children's Theater.
Okay.
And it's a great resource for like kids to learn about the arts and stuff. But we try and bring comedy shows up there as regularly as we can, which is not as much as we used to be able to.
Yeah.
Just because of time constraints with running a business. But, because there isn't like there's not the selection there is in Burlington. You know, there's not something to do every night of the week. And there is definitely like limited comedy up there. So we like to bring that to them as much as we can and help people laugh up there.
And you probably get a good enthusiastic turnout.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's, you know, sometimes we've done short form improv shows. We've done long form improv shows. We've done stand up comedy shows up there. And they bring out a different crowd every time. Of course, there are the same group of like 20 people who always come to every show, and they're super pumped.
Well, that's the same here.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it is the same here. Yeah, there's just more people here more random people here that show up.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, true. Where do you play when you're up there? What venues have you been working at?
Oh gosh, I think the first shows we ever did in the Northeast Kingdom were at Parker Pie in Glover, which is a pizza place, which is primo. It's really great pizza. And they have a stage. They have a room with a stage like up in a loft. And it's an interesting setup. The fire alarm went off when we were doing a show once, and everyone I mean, everyone who goes there is a regular there. And they were like, oh, it happens all the time. Just keep going. Just keep going. We're like, oh, gosh, I hope they're not lying. And then there was a place called The Stage in Lindenville that doesn't exist anymore. Okay. It was open for a couple years. We would do some shows there. We've played Linden State College, the Alexander Twilight Theater there. We've done a couple improv shows. And Nathan did a stand-up show there once. And Catamount Arts.
Yeah.
And then Nathan, there's also Nathan's family has a like a studio space where they used to put on shows as kids.
Gotcha.
And we've also put on a couple shows in that studio space, like out in Sheffield.
Yeah.
You kind of have to know where it is to go. But, you know, his sister is a musician and she'll do shows there, too. So, like, you know, there's friends and family and word of mouth situation ends up with a crowd of, you know, like 40 people in this little studio out in the middle of nowhere. It's really fun.
That's sizable. Yeah, I'm heading up to the Northeast Kingdom, heading up to Newport and Barton and Walcott and stuff next weekend. So I've heard good stuff.
For
about
what?
Just to get away.
Yeah, awesome.
You know, just like Friday and Saturday.
Yeah.
Yeah, my wife and I need to get out of town for 48 hours.
It's a great place
hours.
To go yeah. and like kind of disconnect from everything. And
exactly.
You're not going to run into, I mean, you won't run into anyone you know. If we went up there, we probably would because it's a small place and everyone knows everyone. But yeah, it's really cool. Newport has the lake too.
Yeah, well, I don't want to get into my date plans, my weekend getaway plans. But you're growing up in the Northeast Kingdom, and at some point you must have realized, well, maybe the world's bigger than this little corner of Vermont.
Yeah.
So what was the thought process that you moved to New York, right?
Uh-huh,
How did you get up the nerve? What was driving you to make that jump?
So as an adult, I'll preface this with saying, as an adult, I love and appreciate the Northeast Kingdom. And I totally, like, my parents are still there. I love going up there to visit. It's beautiful. I really appreciate it a lot. As a child, I did not appreciate it as much. I felt like it was boring and there wasn't anything to do and there wasn't any diversity. And there also was like a... Not everyone, but there was definitely like a strong contingent of people who didn't really like value education. And I was a smart kid. I was a nerd. I didn't have a ton of friends. But I loved to read. I was like so curious about learning new things. And I knew that there was a world beyond the Northeast Kingdom. But I just needed to get out and meet different kinds of people and stuff because it's very kind of like your worldview up there is pretty limited.
Yeah.
It's like a little bubble a little bit. So, moving to New York was, I couldn't wait to get there.
Did you move for college or just to move?
Yeah, I moved for college. That's like a whole story in and of itself. I was going to go to college for biology and I had already been accepted into this program at the University of Maryland. And then I kind of had a little bit of a nervous breakdown. and I just switched last minute. I withdrew and I applied for schools in New York. And then I just went in the fall. So it was awesome. I mean, there were things that like summer camps, for example, summer camps, like sleepaway camps.
Yeah.
I did not think those were real things. I had no, until we were there and people at school were talking about these experiences they had, I had no frame of reference for that at all. Like, that was not something that people did in the Northeast Kingdom, send kids away to camp. So I thought it was like a device for movies and TV.
It is kind of a luxury, you know, sending your kids because it's not cheap and it's a different lifestyle to be able to send your kids away for the summer.
Right. It's definitely, I mean, the Northeast Kingdom is a REAP zone. So it's a REAP zone. It's rural. It's a poverty zone, basically.
Gotcha.
You know, we weren't working with a lot of money up there. My family wasn't, and most families weren't up there. So, and still aren't. Actually, it's worse now than it was when I was a kid. But, you know, it also is, you're living in a summer camp, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like, yeah, you're in the Northeast Kingdom.
Like, there are lakes, everyone's got a canoe or access to a canoe, and you have to make your own adventure. You've got bikes, you've got hiking trails, you've got all this stuff that that's why people send their kids away. I mean, in addition to get rid of their kids for the summer, but yeah. you know, they send them to go be out in nature, and we were in nature, so right. What's the point? But yeah, it was definitely like a little bit of a culture shock moving to New York, and but I loved it. It was great, and I definitely got like quickly educated about different things that were going on in the world that I had no idea
such
about.
As?
I mean, even like stores. I know that sounds so silly, but like I didn't know what H&M was. I didn't know what Target was. I had never heard of Target. So yeah. Like people, I kind of got treated as like this little weird, I don't know, this like project for all the people at school testing like what I had heard of and what I hadn't, because like
you were like the novelty.
Yeah,
down in New York City.
I was like an Amish person, basically. Like they looked at me like I was an Amish person, in that like when it comes to things that I could learn in school, in books, like history and art and, you know, that kind of stuff, I knew all of that stuff. But then when it came to like pop culture and things that were taking place in like larger cities and stuff, I had no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you mean. My wife and I grew up in Philadelphia area, and she grew up in Newport. Mm-hmm. So we were talking about bands from the 80s and the 90s, and I would mention a few bands, and she doesn't know who I'm talking about. I was like, how can you not know such and such? I was talking about the Hooters, who were a Philadelphia band. You've never heard of them.
No, I've never heard of them. I mean, I think Hootie and the Blowfish.
Right, no, yeah, totally different band.
Not them.
But then she's telling me she was listening to Alanis Morissette when she was like a teeny bopper, mm-hmm. bubblegum pop artist, you know, over the border.
Yeah.
From, you know, so that's funny to hear the different perspectives from the same.
Well, that's, I mean, the music, the whole thing with music is that like, unless like a teacher, like I remember I started getting jazz CDs from my high school band teacher, and that was kind of like expanding my musical awareness. Yeah. But other than that, it's like if it wasn't on Magic 97.7, then we didn't know what it was. We didn't hear, you know, we didn't have cable TV until, I mean, we still didn't have cable TV. We ended up getting like a satellite dish, you know.
Yeah.
But that was in high school.
So what?
We had like three channels.
Even through high school. Wow. So what got you into music? You talk about getting, you know, jazz CDs from your music teacher. What was it that made you go from being just a, you know, using your words, a nerd in, you know, middle school, high school? Or did I just answer my own question? Yeah. What got you into music?
I mean,
or performing in general?
I always loved music, and I always loved performing, kind of. I had stage fright as a kid, and straight up through high school, like pretty crippling stage fright.
Yeah.
But I loved dancing. Couldn't afford dance lessons, but my best friend took dance lessons, and then she would teach me stuff. I loved dancing. I loved singing. I think from a very young age, I was like, I want to be a singer when I grow up. And my parents were like, that's not a job. but have fun, but it's not a job. I don't know. It just
so
like,
they didn't discourage you.
No, they were very into us doing as many extracurricular activities as we could.
Yeah.
And as long, especially, I mean, singing doesn't cost money. You know, I took some music.
Sound like you had to buy a guitar or buy a drum set or
right. Well, we started in band in middle school. We started playing in band. My brother played the trumpet and I played the saxophone, and we rented them.
Yeah.
And then we couldn't afford to rent them anymore, so we stopped being in the band. Yeah. So, you know, that was kind of... But then the band teacher asked me if I wanted to, like, sing with the band. So that was helpful. There were a lot of teachers who were very helpful in, like, making sure that all the students who wanted to participate could participate.
Yeah, so. I guess being in that poverty zone, they realized they had to be a little creative with... You know, getting everyone involved.
Totally.
Yeah, because it wasn't always an option.
That middle school band teacher is Nathan's uncle.
Oh, for his whole sake.
Yeah, his whole family is very musical, and they all live in the Northeast Kingdom, and they are basically all music teachers. The woman who taught me how to play the vibraphone and like some percussion stuff in high school is basically his aunt. So, you know.
Small world.
Yeah.
So you ultimately moved back to Vermont after New York. What did you get out of being in New York City? I mean, aside from learning about the different retail outlets.
Right, yeah. I got confidence. I mean, I felt confidence for the first time. I felt like I had found my people. I found some really, like, great, amazing, lifelong friends. I learned a lot about music and about theater. I learned about being an adult. It's very expensive to live there. You know, I didn't have a safety net that some of my friends had. So I was working a ton. I was working in I managed my first restaurant there. It was a really awesome experience. Learned about public transportation.
Yeah. Managed a restaurant.
Yeah.
So that's something that you kind of brought with you, that you've kind of held on to.
Yeah.
It's been a useful, unexpected skill.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've always been a workaholic. If I'm doing something, I'm going to go as hard as I can. And so even with that, one of the reasons I ended up moving back to Vermont was because I was realizing that I might not actually want to do musical theater anymore. I wasn't quite sure what I wanted. It didn't feel right. And especially because that restaurant job ended up taking over my life. I was working like 60 hours a week. I wasn't going to auditions anymore. And it's like, why am I doing that to myself?
Right.
Let's go home. I was thinking maybe I would go back to school and get a teaching license, which I didn't end up doing.
Yeah.
But you
talk about being a workaholic and just wanting to do everything. Sadly, the restaurant job, which was meant to support the performing arts, ended up taking over it.
Totally,
So you come back, and I have to say, you're still pretty darn busy.
Yeah. There's been a lot between then and now, a number of years. I definitely, like the first year that I was back, I slacked off
you earned
a
it.
Lot. Yeah. Now... There's definitely like similarities. I can't help myself. I have to be busy.
Right.
I always want to be improving myself, like the art that I am able to create. But also, if I'm doing like a businessy thing, I really love processes and trying to make things more profitable or more efficient, or you know, it sounds super geeky,
but there's a creative side to that.
Oh, totally, absolutely, yeah. And now I have someone to do that with, and we kind of come at it from two different angles. You know, I do have that more scientific, logical brain, so I think of things linearly. And Nathan, my husband and business partner, is very creative and very like throw everything at the wall, and like he's very big picture and a lot more. He has a lot more of like the traditional creative brain, I think, than I do.
You guys complement each other very well, and the danger in that of taking all that on. You guys seem to be over. You guys seem to get past the just how crazy. I mean, I'm sure there's madness involved.
Your relationship's over, right? That's not what you meant, but that's what it sounds like in my head. You're over, right? No.
Right. No. But you've gotten past, or you seem to be, you're not letting it get in the way, because you're still fully functional as business people and as creative artists.
Yeah, it kind of goes back and forth. We're in a place right now where we are really trying to streamline the operations of the Clamity Club so that we can take even another step back. We're both wanting to write a lot more. We basically, the last 3 or 4 years, we stopped doing stand-up comedy altogether, because improv is like totally in the moment. We rehearse once a week and we do a show once a week, and that's our time. But like stand-up is a lot more work intensive when it comes to like writing out bits and refining bits and going up at as many open mics as possible, and you know, we both are interested in getting back into that. It's just we haven't had the time to write. And the same with sketch. Like, we're both very interested in sketch. And so we have notebooks from the last 4 years of sketch ideas and joke ideas. Yeah. And
that just haven't had the time to develop.
Right, exactly. We haven't been able to flesh them out at all. So we're hoping that's kind of like our goal this year, is to give ourselves a little more creative
Well, here's the thing that blows my mind is I see you guys, whether it's with the Unmentionables or the Kingdom Kids, you're up on stage at the Vermont Comedy Club, which is a club that you two run. And so you know the ins and outs, you know, the bottom lines, the income, the expenses, and you still get on that same stage and clear your head of all of that. How do you find the discipline to be an improv performer, which really requires shutting all that stuff off when you're right there in the middle of the physical place that has to be occupying your concerns and worries day to day? I don't know if I just made things worse for you.
No, it took me about a year. Yeah. We've been open for 2+ years now. And it took me about a year to be able to completely unplug during the improv shows. Yeah. I remember when we first opened, you know, we work like 80-hour weeks. It's nuts. And when we first opened, I was holding on to this feeling of like, this is that 1 hour that I'm on stage is my me time. And so if anything went wrong, I would get irrationally angry while I was on stage.
And that's not conducive.
And it's not, no, not at all. I mean, like, I wasn't, my head wasn't in the shows. You know, it was just, so whether it was that, you know, we were understaffed, or that like a table in the front had empty glasses on it that weren't getting bussed, or the worst was when people were taught, like if there was an audience member who was talking during the show, I would like lose my mind. And then I kind of was just like, I can't do this to myself. I need to let go of this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it really did become like my happy time, when I can just unplug. I really pay attention to my teammates and this imaginary world that we're creating. And I get to really step out of the stress of running the club and just be in the moment. So is there, I think, just practice and like mental, I don't know, just like an acceptance. Yeah. Emotionally and mentally, that whatever happens, whatever's happening off stage, I don't, you know, I'll deal with it later.
Yeah, it'll still be there.
It'll still be there, or it wasn't as bad as that's the other thing is, like, I will fixate on little things. So, like a table that's not pre-bussed, is that going to kill me or anyone else? No.
No.
It's not going to, no, it's not. Just let it go.
Yeah, accepting it, there's... Letting go, that's what I'm constantly wrestling with myself as a, you know, when I'm writing or even when I'm doing something on stage and, you know, it beats me up after the fact. And there's the acceptance thing. I could just say let it go, but that almost feels like denial in a sense. But accepting it and saying, okay, well, that was a bad choice, Adam, or that you just derailed, you know, a bit of the scene by doing this, or you derailed the song or whatever by forgetting this or making that choice that you should have known better. But just accept it and say, okay, you know, I need to be there for the next verse.
Totally.
I need to be ready for, you know, the next downbeat.
Yep. I think that's what improv teaches, right? Is acceptance of any choice that you make. There are no mistakes in improv. So, the more you do it, I think the easier it is to, you know, it takes over your mentality. It reroutes the pathways in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, first of all, that again, like, oh, you make a mistake, you miss a chord, you're playing, you know.
Right.
No one's going to die.
Yeah.
This is also from, I've always had, but only recently, in the last couple of years, had a diagnosis and treatment for extreme anxiety. So that's a very similar thing, which is like, you know, anxiety is caused from your pathways get quickened so that you think that it's like fight or flight for everything.
Yeah.
Like the smallest things. Oh, I spilled a cup of coffee and now I'm having an anxiety attack. Is someone going to die because of that coffee? No, right? Yeah. So that's kind of what I always am thinking, like, is this really a life or death situation? No, then I can like relax about it.
Yeah. It's easier said than done, because they still pop up every now and then, and it's having that foresight. I think what's helped me in recent years is having lived through it a few times, having screwed up a few times.
Oh, totally.
And then coming out on the other side of it saying, yeah, well, we're still here.
Yeah. It's the same thing with a business, really. Like, you know, it, that you go through with any small business, you go through ups and downs, and
hopefully, like, you learn from the downs.
Yeah. You learn from the downs. And so the downs aren't as down, but when you're going into like a slow season, like, what, you know, our business is definitely seasonal. I mean, we are open all year round, but there's a seasonality to it. It's slower during the summer. So the second summer, the first summer, we knew it was going to happen, but we didn't know how it would like affect us emotionally and physically. And so that happened. And then the second summer, we kind of knew what to expect. And it wasn't as bad the second summer.
Were the numbers not as bad, or was your attitude toward it not as bad?
Both.
Okay.
Both. You know, it's still a lot. It's a lot slower in the summer than it is in the winter months. But we also, you know, we learned to prepare for it a little bit. So we're still, okay, well, then our busy months, we're going to stock a little bit more away in this other account. And then, you know, by the end of the summer, it's depleted. The accounts, you know, but it's, we're learning. It's all a learning process. But yeah, I think just emotionally too, like, I can handle certain things a little bit better now. At the beginning, you think you're going out of business all the time. Like, that's, you know, and you're not. You're not even it's not even close. But in your mind, it's like this panic all the time. Or maybe just me. Maybe that's just my anxiety. I don't know.
I don't think it's just you. I would imagine everyone running a business. But to your point, which I think we were kind of hinting at, is that your skills, your experience as an improviser has kind of prepared you for running the business.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, definitely it's helpful in like that acceptance of whatever is happening and creative problem solving. And, you know, our improv training really helped us, in doing the design of the business, in doing the program. Like, Nathan and I work very collaboratively together, and we try to yes and each other all the time and explore all of the different possibilities that are in front of us. And usually we don't get into arguments very often. When we do, it's always about some kind of work thing. And when that happens, we have the awareness to take a step back and be like, oh, we are negating each other so hard right now.
Yeah.
And then we can flip it. We can be like, okay, we're going to start over. Take this and let's yes and this situation. So that's been the most helpful thing. Just the awareness, like being able to feel and know when we're negating each other, and then being able to take a step back and be like, okay, let's start over and we're going to go forward. And then it's usually solved in like 2 minutes.
Right.
We've been fighting about it for 20 minutes and it's solved in 2 minutes once we like flip our attitudes and start yes anding each other. It's crazy.
That's excellent. You talk about your comedy training, because you were doing, you went to New York, you were studying music and musical theater.
Yeah.
How did you make that jump from music into comedy? And I think, if I'm not mistaken, you started with stand-up.
Yeah, I did start with stand-up. It's funny, because when I was in college, you know, a cross between that perfectionist mentality and my anxiety, there was an improv class that we had to take. It was like a section of an acting class that we took, and I hated it. I was like, the idea that I couldn't control everything totally freaked me out. You know, this was when I was like 19 or something. And so that was my first experience with improv. Before that, of course, as a kid, I watched Whose Line Is It Anyway? I loved it. I watched all kinds of comedy specials and Saturday Night Live, like the reruns of Saturday Night Live, especially like the cast with Anna Gasteyer and Will Ferrell. And like, I loved comedy. But I didn't think it was like a possibility. It never even occurred to me, again, maybe this is like a Northeast Kingdom thing, but it never even occurred to me that it could be a career of any kind. And then, but in school, I always got cast into funny roles. They never, my teachers, I don't think I had a single serious scene, like my entire
education. What was it your drama teacher saw in you that they saw you as this comic role?
I mean, it was my, I had built up this like defense mechanism, like, you know, all nerds do, but through humor, like that was what it was. So I have
no idea what you're talking about. By the way.
Yeah, right. I didn't know it, but I was fun. I was funny. And also at the time I was, I still am. I have a lower voice. I'm not a skinny blonde.
Right.
So I'm not going to be the ingenue. I'm not going to have the love scenes. I'm not going to have ballads and stuff. I'm going to have like sassy, funny songs. That's who I am. And I hated that. I was like, I just want to do something serious. I want to be a serious actor, which of course, no. If I, you know, I've done a couple of serious roles in plays over the last decade and it's great, but I love comedy so much
more.
Do
you feel at home or how do you find yourself fitting into those dramatic roles, into the serious roles?
It's harder. I mean, it's a lot harder for me because I'm used to, I'm used to cracking jokes. Well, I'm used to like...
You hear that adage that, you know, comic actors can pick up drama faster than a dramatic actor could pick up comedy.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
But here you are feeling more at home in the comedic roles,
which is
telling.
Yeah. So then, you know, I started in stand-up. Basically, what happened was Nathan started doing stand-up, and I didn't really have... At that time, there was, like, a period of time where he started doing that, where I wasn't in the band yet that we were in together.
Yeah.
And I didn't really have an outlet, like a performance outlet. I was really missing that, and I went to a couple open mics that he was doing, and I just sat and watched for maybe, like, a month, maybe 2 months. And by the end of that, I was like, I can't just sit here anymore. I have to get up. I'm funnier than half of these people. I'm going to get up and do this.
Yeah.
And Kathleen Kahns, who was basically like one of the only people who was producing shows at the time, just knew me as Nathan's girlfriend who had a great laugh, who came to all the shows. And I mentioned to her that I was going to try, like I was thinking about trying it. And she's like, oh, I'll give you 5 minutes on a show. Just like work up material. I'll give you 5 minutes on next month's show. So just like a little bit of encouragement from her. And then I got hooked like immediately.
Was this around the time? But you joined Hot Neon Magic with me around that same time or before or after?
I think it was after, but not by much.
Yeah, because I remember when you auditioned for the band, I don't think you were doing...
Oh, I wasn't? Oh, maybe. I don't know.
You were. Yeah, I don't know. It was right around because you auditioned and then we hired you like 9 months later.
Right. Oh, maybe it was during that off period.
Yeah. Yeah, you were, to give everyone background, we were down to two people, and I wanted to pick you for our new lead singer, and the rest of the band was like, no, let's get this other woman. I was like, I don't know. Anyway, so the other woman didn't work out. She had to move out of town, and then I got to say, I told you so to everybody. And then you sang with us for a few years.
2 years. It was really fun. I miss it. Every time an 80s song comes on the radio, I'm like, aw. Ornan and Jeff and Adam, Lefty.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole gang. So how was it? I got to ask you about Hot Neon Magic. Now that you're several years out from singing these 80s tunes, which...
Oh, man. It was great. Working with a keyboard player was horrible. No, I'm just kidding. That's Adam. It was really fun. I mean, honestly, that gave me another level of confidence, too. Mm-hmm. I got to be someone that had sex appeal, which is something I had never done before.
You
in
really
any role.
Worked it up. You got some great Cyndi Lauper outfit kind of things going.
I got outfits. I got makeup. I would do my hair, tease out my hair and stuff. And it was really fun to play that role because that wasn't anything that anyone had ever seen me as before. Yeah, I mean, I learned something new about myself, I think, and also it was really fun. Like you remember how like we all always used to, after the shows, I would like go into the bathroom and change and put on a sweatshirt and like take my hair down, put my glasses on, and then I would come out and be totally incognito. Like, it was, it was like people didn't recognize me. I just put glasses on. It was a very Clark Kent Superman situation.
Yeah.
So it was fun. I felt like I had this little secret personality.
You mentioned walking that line. Excuse me, my voice is breaking. I must be going through the change. The you talk about like that sex appeal, which I never really thought about, but you did. You walked a line very well, which I kind of knew you would, with given your theater background, of because 80s covers, you know, doing Safety Dance and Video Killed the Radio Star and Love is a Battlefield, you want to have a little bit of that sex appeal, but there's also like the novelty act of it.
Oh,
totally. There's a humor behind all of it, as well as the sex appeal. And that's what some of my favorite artists from the 80s did that. You know, Cyndi Lauper was great at it. Not so much Pat Benatar, because she was just smoking straight up.
Yeah.
But then you got Dale Bozzio from Missing Persons, and you really embraced that walking that line, and that was fun to watch.
Thanks. Yeah, it was really fun. I mean, it was fun to interact with you guys too, and everyone in the band had such a good sense of humor in their own different way. Like,
yeah, and you. So you've never sang in a band before, because there was a theatrical element to Hot Neon Magic, because we were pretending to be somebody else. Like we weren't band, like, this is our music, you know? But at the same time, it was a rock band, and there's less formality to it than, say, a theater troupe or an improv troupe. You know, like if someone shows up late to practice, it's like, all right, well, you know, we'll get started without them. In a theatrical environment, it's like, no, you're there. Every single...
Yeah, like single, you would get fired instantly. Yeah. Yeah. I had never been in a band before, and I liked the structure, but also like that there was a little bit of like flow. It was different too, with like I had to kind of try to grit up my voice a little bit, because I had like classical training, and
that's right, we went through a little bit of that.
So that was really interesting, and it's funny because now all of the musical theater schools have shifted over to teach, not all of them, like not Juilliard, but, you know, most of them have shifted over to teach more of a rock pop style of vocal training, because that's kind of where musical theater is going right now.
We have microphones now.
Yeah, right.
and in classic theater, you got to sing to the back of the room. And I remember you did that like the first few practices and maybe the first couple shows. And I remember me and maybe some of the other guys saying, you have a mic.
Yeah.
You know, just you know.
Yeah, yeah. But it's interesting. I wish I had had more of that training. But I see, like, you know, I taught voice lessons for a number of years when I came back, and to high school and middle school students. And now all of them are in college or graduated from college.
Yeah, try not to think about that.
Yeah, I know. It's the worst. But, you know, they went through, like, intensive pop and rock training.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just stylistically, too. It's like people aren't writing Rodgers and Hammerstein style songs anymore. Musical theater mirrors what's going on in contemporary music, so of course it's going to be more pop rock. So it's just interesting to see.
And then you left Hot Neon Magic, I think, because, I mean, for a number of reasons, but I remember one of them being that you wanted to take the comedy route a little more seriously.
Yeah, so there were two things. That was the biggest thing, which was, Nathan and I were going to open Spark Arts, which was our first business that kind of like morphed into. I mean, we had Vermont Comedy Club as a booking agency at the time, and then we wanted to open a theater space, or a not a theater space, a classroom space, so that we could teach more classes and stuff. Also, that I could take my voice lessons out of our living room and into a space that wasn't our living room.
Yeah.
So that was really exciting. And then at the same time, I was having some vocal problems that I was afraid that I was going to wreck my voice if I kept going. And of course, now I don't sing at all. When I do sing, I feel horrible because I feel like I let my voice go. You know, I haven't practiced in a very long time. I haven't, you know, I just don't really do a lot of singing anymore.
Well, you can only keep up with so much at one time.
Right. Well, and that's really not, you know, that's not where I'm going anymore. Like I I love, there is a part of me that I would like to be able to get back into something theatrical again. Nathan and I have talked about writing like a two-person sketch show for ourselves where there would be like musical comedy elements and parody songs and stuff like that, which I think is what I would do. But I don't know that I'll ever do like a musical again. You know, that's, it's just not where I'm at mentally.
You've had so many opportunities. You've taken on so many different like aspects of performing arts between, you know, mm-hmm. drama and comedy and even within comedy, stand up and improv and sketch.
Mm-hmm.
How do you figure out, because there's only 24 hours in a day and 8 of them or 12 of them are taken up by running the business.
Right.
How do you balance your artistic ambitions with, I was going to say with your adult responsibilities, but really with just the limit of number of hours in the day?
Yeah. I mean, that again, that's something that like we're working on, and we haven't been super successful at with the work-life balance or work and creative balance over the last couple of years, just because, you know, we need to put all of this effort into the club to make sure that, you know, it's about more than us, basically. Like, we're creating this space so that there is a home for comedy where people can come and learn about comedy and perform comedy and have this community and stuff. So, you know, and we have a bunch of employees and, you know, so we feel a lot of pressure to like put as much effort into building the club up and getting it to a point where it can run by itself. And then we can pull ourselves back and be like, oh, okay, now we have like not unlimited free time to be creative, but a lot more.
Yeah.
But I've lost the question. I've lost the question.
Yeah, no, it's balancing. It's, yeah.
Right,
balancing.
Yeah. So it's...
And also prioritizing and pacing yourself.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's... So now, this year, my like goal... Mm-hmm. My goals are to read more, because the other thing with like writing more comedy or just any comedian or any performer in general needs to continue to learn, not just about comedy, but about literally everything, because the bigger your scope is as far as like, you know, oh, I know a lot about Theodore Roosevelt, like that. Who knows if that'll come in handy? It might. It probably will. Like, I know Nathan read a book about the Wright brothers and then someone randomly brought it up in a scene and they didn't even know that he knew that much about them, but he knew everything about them. And so it turned into this really fun thing.
So what are you looking to expand your knowledge about right now?
A little bit of everything, but also like, also get into more pop culture stuff. Like, I read the first book of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
I can't watch the TV program because I can't watch, like, violent... I can't do violent stuff. I can read it, but I can't watch it. So I read that, and we're taking a trip next week, and I'm going to bring that book along with me. But I'm also... You know, I try to balance between comedy stuff and, like, normal stuff. So like podcasts... I try not to just listen to comedy podcasts all the time or just read comedy books, even though that's really, I am so interested in the history of comedy and in biographies and stuff. So, you know, the first two books I've read this year are Poking a Dead Frog, which is a great book of interviews with comedy writers.
Yeah.
And it has real like practical knowledge about like, oh, how could you do this as a career and all these different fun stories. And then Eddie Izzard's memoir that he wrote, who he's one of my favorite comedians of all time. And it was just really interesting to learn about his life. I didn't really know much about it. So
he had an interesting background.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love the idea of the intellectualization of comedy. And I mean, because that's, you know, maybe that's just where you and I connect, is that we're kind of brainiac.
Yeah.
You know, we kind of take a, you know, you want to say a good comedian doesn't make you think, they just make you laugh and they make you feel fun and good. But, you know, some people love to really dig into, like you say, the history, but also the philosophy, what works, what doesn't work, why things change. And so it's interesting that there is that outlet to, there is that path to read about
Yeah. Well, there's a book, there's a great book called The Comedians, which is like the history of stand-up comedy. Mm-hmm. There's a book that I am also bringing on vacation called Improv Nation. That's the history of improv in the United States, which is cool. And then, you know, reading about anything, learning about a lot of stuff is so important because, especially for improvisers, but for stand-ups too, but for literally everyone, for people who aren't comedians, just read and learn things.
Right.
But for improv, there's a thing called playing to the top of your intelligence, where you might not know everything about a subject, but you're supposed to play to the top of your intelligence. So use your common sense and your, you know, your mind to find what you do know about that. Even if it's like, you know, you're playing an airline pilot. Okay, I know they flick a lot of buttons, so you're flicking buttons, whatever it is. But the more you know about things, the more you can elevate that. Because it's like, oh, now I know so much about this at a whole other level. So what are the things that I don't know about it? You know, it's just interesting.
You started out with stand-up, and then I think, if I'm not mistaken, you went into short form. You had a short form group, and then you moved on to long form.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I got introduced to comedy. And I think a lot of people, like, we think about stand-ups and then sketch, and then we see, you know, Whose Line Is Anyway, which, you know, everyone knows about, and that kind of approach. But then the long form, I didn't even get that. When I started taking the improv comedy, I was just thinking short form.
Yeah.
And I didn't really have that exposure to long form. It didn't make sense to me right away. I'm curious about your thoughts on if it's your evolution or if it's like just the comedy world's evolution going in that direction, just like the overall trends that you see in comedy.
I think that I don't like to kind of pick sides or like have a camp in the short form versus long form argument, because I feel like there is a place for both of those things and that they're both valid art forms.
I'm not looking for a comparison. I'm thinking more like chronologically and the development of and the direction that you think things are going.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
why?
I think that things are going a little. I mean, they're definitely going towards long form in all of the clubs around the country. I mean, there's still like Comedy Sports, which is like a short form competitive form, but I think things are going towards long form. It's going towards like a narrative, like more a narrative thing, or you know, UCB is very game centric. This is not going to make sense to anyone who's listening who doesn't know about improv. And Second City does and has always done improv to sketch. So that's why that is like, you know, it's these more long form based scenes, so that it's you're doing that and then you're writing down what worked and then you're refining it. And then this improv now turns into sketch, which I think is super interesting, like a really interesting way to write sketches. And I know Kevin McDonald from
Kids in the Hall
he's coming back too. But the first time he came to the club and did a sketch workshop, he was talking about how that's how they wrote their sketches too. It's just a fun way to like get yourself out of your head. And
it's not that different from being in a band where you jam,
right?
You pick a key and you jam, and then you listen back to the tapes and you're like, okay, that part worked. Let's turn that into an actual song.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Yeah.
So given that, where do you see Vermont Comedy Club? Where would you like to see it head over the next year or two or five?
I mean, I love long form. I love short form too for its own thing. Like most of our corporate shows are short form shows.
Yeah.
Just because it's more accessible. The family friendly shows are short form shows because you can get kids up on stage. It's more interactive throughout the entire show, which I think is great in that setting. I want to, the other thing is that like short form has these little games, right?
Yeah.
You can create new games and be innovative in that way. But with long form, you can really push yourself to create new forms, get experimental. There are so many different, I mean, there's so like millions of different forms that already exist. So I want to see our students and our house teams and all the indie teams in town really pushing themselves and challenging themselves to try different kinds of long form things that are like terrifying, like mono scenes, for example, which is like a full set Basically, it would be like if you have a 45-minute set, it's a 45-minute scene.
Huh.
With the same characters in one location.
Right.
That is in real time.
That's heavy.
Yeah, it's a lot. You know, like, you don't get to edit. You don't, there's no, you have to, like, dig yourself out of whatever hole you put yourself in yeah. real time. So,
If you make a choice, it sticks with you for the next 45
totally.
Minutes.
Yeah.
And you got to develop it.
Yep.
That's something that I can definitely see that. It seems like a natural evolution, going longer and longer.
Yeah. And I love that there's musical improv going on now. Like, that is really fun. I would like to, personally, I'd like to do a lot more of that, because I think that in that kind of gets all of my skills, puts all of my skills to use. And there are forms within musical improv, too.
I'm starting to look into that also. It's endless. I mean, because for the same reason, you know, the music background and then the performance. And I love making stuff up.
Yeah.
You know, I love making things.
Yeah. There's a cool thing, too. Like, you know, right now our corporate shows are short form shows, but Improv Boston does this. They developed this thing called All Form, which is kind of like a combination of long form and short form.
Yeah.
Which I would love to learn more about, because I feel like that is
that sounds interesting.
Cool.
The thing that I'm digging long form, and I like where that can go. The one thing I miss is that constant interaction in a short form show, because in a short form show. Yeah. You have games every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So you're addressing the audience. You're getting feedback from the audience. You're including them more often. Whereas in a long form, you get, you know, you talk for a few minutes at the beginning and then you're off and running for the rest of the hour.
Right. Yeah.
And I do miss that. So I'm very curious to learn about that. I never heard of that until just now. So
yeah,
it sounds
cool.
Very interesting.
Yeah. They're Mike, and he's just a great teacher. We'll bring him up to do an all form workshop sometime, maybe this year. Mike, are you listening to this? No way, you're in Boston. But it's cool. It's it's a long form show, but then they have a bell, basically, and in the middle of just a normal scene, they'll just ding the bell, and then they'll get suggestions from the audience for whatever it is, and then they'll insert a short form game into the long form scene that's happening.
Excellent.
And then you can use, so in addition to like the callbacks you might do, like the comedic callbacks you might do in a normal thing and connections, you can also call back to a game that's been played, like a short, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
It's really cool to watch.
There is that experimental, there's that frontier that I feel like comedy, the improv comedy, is still going up against.
Oh, it's endless, because you're just creating it on the spot. So
yeah.
I would love to see brand new forms coming out of people in Vermont. I think that would be really exciting.
That would be. Well, cool. Let's move on to the closing section, where we talk about some of your favorite things about Vermont.
Great.
Yeah, here's the rapid fire lightning round.
Great. I already forget what I said, so we'll try and I was thinking about these, but
the first thing I'm going to ask you about is your favorite Vermonter.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I've got two. So my favorite Vermonters are Pamela Paulston, who runs 7 Days, because she is just a, can I say, bad,
well,
can I say
it's
swear
an FCC.
On here?
No, you
oh,
can't.
Oh, no. Okay, great. So she is awesome. If I could swear, I would, to emphasize how awesome she is. And she's just been so helpful to me as another female entrepreneur and business owner. I've sat down with her for coffee and dinner a number of times, and I just, you know, she's the kind of person that I run into on the street, and it makes my entire week. And then my other favorite person is Sergey from Nectars. He's the sound engineer at Nectars, and I love him so much. Most people are terrified of Sergey, and I just don't have that. I just don't have that problem. I just adore him. He's hard on the outside and soft on the inside.
Yep, I've played Nectars a few times, and he's definitely, you know, he's got a job to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, while
everyone
around him is partying and drinking and listening to music, he's got a job to do. So I get, you know, you appreciate that. So he's like, okay, I got to set this mic stand up. I need you to check your things, but yeah.
Well, honestly, like if you are kind to the equipment and you respect like the equipment and the job, then it's not a problem. And he's so interesting, you know, he's from Russia. He's so interesting.
Yeah.
If you ever get a chance to talk to him, listeners out there, You should, but not when he's working.
Not when he's new.
No.
No, don't.
Not when he's working.
Tell me about your favorite Vermont place.
Oh, sure. So my favorite Vermont place is anywhere with my dog. I like going places with my dog. My dog's name is Tina. And
not just Tina.
Tina Fey.
Yeah.
And we go to the Whale's Tales, the little like, it's not even a park, but just a field. It's off near the highway, but there's a fence. And it's, you know, those giant Whale's Tales on 89. There's a park there and you can let your dogs off leash and she runs around and it's so fun. And we go to the Ethan Allen Trail. We go to Star Farm Dog Park.
Yeah.
And I just love watching my dog run around and play with other dogs. That's my happy place.
Excellent. And your favorite memory, you touched on this earlier. You did a comedy show in the loft of a barn. What that was at Parker Pie, right?
At Parker Pie, yeah. I mean, there have just been we've done comedy shows in a lot of different places.
What's
and
the
so,
weirdest place you ever did a comedy show?
Probably on a dock, like out into the lake. Outside.
Outside,
actually,
that's rough.
Yeah, we've done a number of outdoor gigs and they are the worst. They are just the worst. At least on the dock, they had like a tent over it. They put a tent up over it. So it was almost like we were inside. But outdoor gigs are the worst because the laughter just goes up and into the ether. You can't hear anything. They can't hear you. You can't hear them. It's a nightmare.
Yeah.
But yeah, that loft gig was so... That was just so Northeast Kingdom and so Vermont. And then a fire alarm is going off and they're like, nah, just keep going. It happens all the time.
Yeah.
And the green room there is like, it's crazy. It's like the stage is 5 feet off the ground and the green room is off of the stage in like a cubby hole. Like you imagine, you know, Harry Potter's cupboard under the stairs.
Yeah.
That's what the green room is. Off of the stage. And there's no way out of the green room except onto the stage.
Oh, you just go right onto the stage.
You go right onto the stage and there's no escaping. So like if we had to leave, we would all have to like pile out onto the stage and then climb down a ladder to get off the stage and then climb down another ladder to get out of the loft. And then, you know, it's very Vermont.
Yeah. And there's no danger in that, I'm sure.
Yeah. None.
Yeah. Hopefully no one at the fire department is listening. Your favorite Vermont food or drink?
There's so much good food in Vermont, and I love food. I love to eat. So I love coffee. I'm all about coffee. I love Onyx Tonics. It's on College Street. It's relatively new, but Jason is the owner, and he is like a world-renowned coffee taster. He's won world championships for coffee tasting.
We have a few of those around town.
Yeah, he's so interesting and so friendly, and I love the decor in there. Of course, Muddy Waters, which feels like you're walking into a Hobbit house, is also great. And Mark, the owner, is awesome.
Yeah.
I love Rainbow Sweets. If you haven't been to Rainbow Sweets in Marshfield, you just need to go. It's an experience. It's closed for like 3 months out of the year because the owners go to Europe.
Yeah.
But the guy, it's like a whole sales pitch. It is so, it's intense. It's an intense experience.
Yeah.
But it's so fun and really delicious. And then what else? Fo Hong. I love Fo Hong.
Can't go wrong there.
Can't go wrong.
It's been too long. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, go. We'll go after this.
Sounds good. How can people find you and stuff you do online? I think we know.
But. Yeah. I mean, VermontComedyClub.com and I'm on Instagram. Tina also has an Instagram.
Oh, what are the handles?
At Tina Fey Dog. And I think my Instagram handle is Natalie J. Miller. I think. I don't know. Not 100% sure.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for joining me for the hour. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, this has been great.
All right. You've been listening to Vermont Favorites. Vermont Favorites is a production of WBTV LP 99.3 FM Burlington. And you can listen online at 993wbtv.org. You can follow Vermont Favorites on Facebook to find out about upcoming guests. And you can subscribe to the podcast and catch up on any episodes you may have missed at imadeitup.com. Thank you again for listening. Talk to you very soon. Take care.